Greetings, Spaceburgers. This is David Huntsberger, transmitting from a cave deep in the recesses of space. I hope you've made yourselves nice and warm and comfortable wherever you may be positioning yourselves in the deep ether and giving yourself, wrapping yourselves in a nice, comfortable warg. The tour is going well so far. The next Junk Show is July 10th in Los Angeles at the Copper Still. It's the second Sunday of every month. If you find yourself in Los Angeles, then drop by and see a collection of talented people from a lot of different realms of creativity. Animators, filmmakers, storytellers, musicians, magicians. It's fun. I hope to see you there. And yeah, the tour is going well. I'm recording this from a hotel room in Columbus, and so I can't speak as to how the shows in Chicago, Milwaukee, or Madison went, but perhaps I'll have a patch in from the not-so-distant future, which will be the recent past by the time you listen to this, or who knows when you're listening to it. Maybe it's the distant past. Thank you to Matt, the greatest of Spaceburgers, not only came to the show in Columbus, but drove in from Cleveland to do so, which is pretty terrific. And thank you for bringing me some CDs to listen to. I haven't listened to them yet, but I am excited. Let's check in with part two of the ongoing chat with Riley Newton from the Bridgetown Comedy Festival. Well, we've really gotten into the psyche of you. It's fascinating.
I thought we were talking about Bridgetown.
Yeah, maybe we should delve into that a bit. Because are there three main pillars, you would say, at this point? Andy's kind of the overlord.
Oh, interesting.
In my mind, let me give you a guess of how I think. In my mind, Andy really spearheaded it initially, and then assembled this great team, and now it's kind of Whitney, you, and Helen that are really orchestrating it and moving everything, making
it
all happen.
You're going to be in so much trouble if it stands as that.
Who am I forgetting?
Charlene,
okay. Because I saw her at the meeting, but I also saw like 10 people at the meeting.
Oh, that's interesting. That was, you saw all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's grown. So like the first year, Andy used to go to L.A. He lived here, uh-huh. And he used to go to L.A. for a special thing.
Remember
that message board?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there was this, that was like a whole, like
it was
like
a whole community. It was like kind of like Reddit. Yeah, people sharing stuff.
And so they would, from different places in the country, I don't think that far away, maybe San Francisco, Oregon, maybe further, would go to that overnight thing that they used to do at Death Ray. They would do like an anniversary show, mm-hmm. and like have all like go all night. Remember years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I think, well, no, they don't do it anymore because that show doesn't exist. I don't know
right.
what the name is. So he, this is a long way around the
That's
story.
Okay.
We've got nothing but time. So he went there and I think he like just became a comedy fan. I think he already was. And then, yeah, he just like, he and Matt Bronger and this girl Kim were like at a comedy show and were like, it'd be cool if there was a festival. And then, so that first year it was like Kim, Matt, and then a bunch of LA comics, because that's the people that he knew from visiting
UCB. See.
That's okay. Like how he kind of, I think, knew those people. And I lived here then, so I had moved back from LA, and I didn't really do, you know, much that year, but like it was Andy really pretty much by himself with a sort of small group of, like Kim managed volunteers. And then I think Charlene came in the next year, and like it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing.
Okay. That makes sense. So I wasn't too far. I know that Andy didn't do it on his own, but for whatever reason, to me, like he seemed like the one that was the most stressed out, like, you know, really orchestrating all the stuff. But Matt had a hand in it, and then Kim, and then Charlene came. So Charlene is, so the three that I mentioned, you and Whitney and Helen, Charlene's a part of the four horsemen, horsewomen
now. Charlene got a job this year. This is so many details, but like she got another job, so she kind of stepped away a little bit this year. So then where that large number of people is, like, those are all the people that she trained over the years and basically, like, taught them how to do this.
Okay.
Because there's, like, a lot of weird little, like, I didn't know any of that ground stuff. Like, you have to order shit early, like, all this, I don't know.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Just kind of the little minutiae, the general business, all that
so
stuff.
So it's definitely, like, grown, and I feel like there's Paul, Melissa, Randy. I feel like I'm going to be in trouble. Heather.
You got to name all the people that were just at that meeting?
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that's...
Maura
that's
does press.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of, like, grown, and it's, like, a weird thing, too. I think we're also invested in it in this weird way that it's, like, a limb, almost. Like, this weird, like... It's very difficult to quit. I've quit more than anybody. So many times. It's also hard because, like... I started as a stand-up, and then to kind of move into that other role is a little bit like, why am I managing other people's lives instead of like doing
Are you not
comedy?
Doing as much stand-up because
really
of this?
I don't do it hardly at all anymore.
Oh, no. That doesn't seem
I was
like...
fishing a little there.
That seems... I mean, that just seems... Is it the time element? Or like you said, like it feels weird to... You know, like if you're the general manager of a baseball team, like, let me show you how it's done. You're like, what?
I don't know. It's funny because, like, for me, there is a chip on my shoulder a little bit because, like, I started in 98 doing comedy in L.A. Like, not a great place to start. But
yeah.
And, you know, like, within 3 years, like, good stuff happens. See, I'm bragging now. And but I've quit so many times. I probably quit. Well, definitely more than I've quit Bridgetown. Like, I probably quit 15 times. But there's a little piece of me that, like, I am in this other role where I'm getting your hotel and I'm managing your stuff. And so if you meet me, you don't know that I also do stand up and you don't know whether I'm funny because I'm like fucking stressed out.
Sure. Yeah.
And so like last year I did sets and I remember this girl from LA who I'd gone to her open mic and I'm like, I'm a mess. So I was like, because I'm too sensitive. So like I go to those open mics in LA and like, I don't know anybody there. And then, are they playing cards?
We're getting the ambiance of Bridgetown.
Bridgetown. Yeah, there was a little, like this girl came up afterwards. She's like, you're funny. I was like, yeah, you fucking, not a bitch. Come on. Like, but then it's like, yeah, well, what was I expecting? She doesn't know me in that other capacity.
Yeah. I can understand why you wouldn't want to do it because of that. Like, that's the worst sort of compliment. Like, when people come up and go, that was actually pretty good.
Actually is the
right worst.
There.
That was actually, ugh.
Yeah,
yeah.
For
you
sure.
You That's do not want to hear that.
Well, I'm trying to remember the other phrasing where you're just like, don't bother. You know what? You don't even need to say anything. But yeah, actually is definitely one of them. Because they're basically saying, I'm surprised. I thought you would never in a million years be funny.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I had a kind of a bad set a while ago, and this girl came up that liked it, that was buying merch. And she looks right at me and goes, you weren't that bad.
Oh, God.
And I kind of liked it. Everyone else was like, oh, that's brutal. I was like, nah, it's just being honest. Like,
I was at the Improv one time, and Joni Lowry was there. And she was in the hallway, and she, like, kind of pushed me a little bit. She goes, well, I thought you were funny. And I was like, this is a weird. Everything about this is weird. Like,
yeah.
Ow.
It's like that Mitch Hedberg joke, right? When people come up to him and go, like, the worst compliment is when people say, well, I thought you were funny.
I thought it was the one, because he's at the airport, and someone says something like, I saw you, you were funny. God damn it, I don't remember it, but it was something about somebody saying he was funny in another time. Forget it. Now I'm going to have to look it up.
So do you think you'll quit Bridgetown? Or you said like you're so connected to it, like it's
Andy
like a
sent
limb.
You.
One thing I was going to bring up is that I've gotten emails from you, obviously, like being a part of the festival. And they're very pleasant. They're very, like, you know, the properly placed exclamation points. It's very enthusiastic. And a lot of times when you get those, and I think you and I communicated via email before ever meeting.
Yeah.
And therefore, like, I have an association of who you are based on that.
Oh, that's
which
interesting.
And I think email betrays people so often because, like, when you only get positive sort of things
and now you're having this terrible experience.
No, you're real, you're like a human, you're gonna have moments where you're like, what are you doing, stop it. Even just that little interaction, like when you see just exclamation points, you don't imagine that person ever going, hey, what are you doing, stop it. You just picture them being like, great, fun, excellent, great, here's your thing, you know.
I often question the exclamation point because I am almost never that excited. Like, I would never go, thanks. Like, when I put that on there, I'm just like, I'm so negative that hopefully, like, we never meet. You'll just think I'm really positive.
I do it because I feel like it is mandatory in a certain way. And like, if I look at what I've written in my voice, in my tone, as we're speaking right now, it's all periods. But to see that written, you're like, good Lord, what is this maniac?
You know what I think you're proposing is a new, see, now you're hearing the nasal, is like something between a comma and an exclamation point.
Yeah, I'd like
maybe
something
new, something.
And I don't want to use a smiley face.
Right.
I like there was. Right. I wish there was just a little like a shoulder shrug,
and a wink. You don't know exactly what that might mean.
I do not care for a wink.
Yeah, it's too loaded. You don't know which way to go with it.
And I've never really gotten a wink that I genuinely liked in real life. They're always a little uncomfortable.
I feel like I've delivered a wink where it was like, I am telling you right now to not do this thing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it's been an effective device in that limited capacity.
The bad guy wink is the best, which is like, I'm going to do the right thing, and then, but you're with me on this. But otherwise...
Well, there's a lot of winks.
So many winks. The Texas wink is the worst. Like a good old boy.
Is there a clicking with that? A sound?
Kind of, yeah. They just say a joke and then give you just a quick wink. You're like, ah, what was that? I don't need that. I got the joke. The wink in no way helps.
That's interesting. Really breaking that down.
I think about it probably more than... I mean, have you read the book? Maybe we should go into a part three. Do you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay. Let's reconvene.
You just do these in like 10
I like to do them
segments.
In little 10-minute segments, yeah. Part three, in the future. Coming up, I like her. I like chatting with her. I enjoyed our chat. I hope you're getting something out of it as well. I've talked with comedians who have said, you know, and I understand, you know, like people go, oh man, I don't know if I understand like why you would want to pay a submission fee to a festival that if you get into, and this isn't necessarily Bridgetown, it's kind of all of them, you pay, and then if you get in, you got to fly yourself there, put yourself up, and do shows for free. In principle, definitely against that in comedy. I mean, comedy has no value at this point. However, if you do find yourself getting into one of those festivals, go do it. It's fun. And I don't know that's a topic for another time. We'll have to talk to a comedian about that or something. But, you know, some of the comedians go, I just don't get it. Like, you know, I send in a tape and I don't know what to do. As you've heard from the conversations with Helen and Riley, they want to find the next person they're excited about. They want to expose that person to the world. So hopefully you're that person. If you're a comedian and you're listening and thinking like, I don't know if I should do it. I can say for sure Bridgetown is one of the festivals where actually people go, because it's not that far of a flight, you know, from Hollywood or from L.A. for agents and managers and people that could potentially make your career better. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. I don't know if I have a thought on that. If you don't want to pay the price and you feel like, hey, comedy should be respected and have some value and I should only do it if I'm being paid, I get that. But those festivals are real fun. If you have to pay, think of it as like a fun vacation you get to go to. But beyond that, let's get to the conversation, the bulk of the series. This is part one of a conversation that I had at the Treefort Festival, yet another comedy festival. Well, this is really a small part of a music festival. I was headlining the comedy tent. They're all tents at the Treefort Festival. And you've heard me talk about it on this podcast. It's a fantastic music festival. If you're a band trying to get off the ground, I would highly recommend going to it. It is sort of like South by Southwest, except it really genuinely caters to independent acts. And yet you can get some exposure. So let's move on from that. Professor Blastoff, people would go, stay to, you know, keep it on track, or the kind of that notion. And I don't think this podcast necessarily has that element. It's not something I hold or I stay adamantly about, like that's got to stay on track. This is a conversation that just kind of goes where it will. We're starting to talk about material sciences, but you'll see as the conversation kind of winds in and out and goes where it wants to. I find it just fascinating. I hope you enjoy it too. This is Dylan Haas, who has been great to me and a really funny guy in Boise, and just a nice dude and an interesting guy. When you listen to this episode, I think it's pretty interesting, just his life. And anyway, he doesn't drink, but I had some beer that I think I talk about in the episode. Enjoy part one, Dylan Haas. Can you hear it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to be like in a... never mind.
Whatever you want.
The way we're recording right now, it'll just be in your left.
No, I hear...
Oh, you hear both?
I hear both, yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Well, we're at the Treefort Festival in a hotel room.
You're standing the table.
Oh, boy. Oh, geez. That's pretty strange. I opened that like...
It just started.
A while ago. Okay, just a second. Right, and we're still recording. Dan is gonna love that.
Like, what you don't even edit these yourself?
No, I send them to Dan Pritchard in Australia, and I leave him little notes and stuff, so he won't have to.
Sheesh, how do you get on that gig, Dan? Give me a call. I do that just, for free for like $4 for Emma's podcast, I guess, as well.
Oh, really? It's the Junk Show has a lot of that too. The people that do every part of it, other than me and sure. Emily Rose, it's like lights, sound, the door, giving people the light, all that is just people, and photography.
It's really cool. I just assumed the venue doing all that.
No,
there's just people doing all that for you.
Yeah, people that just like the show and said, "Hey, can I help?" And I was like, "Absolutely!" And
you have a graced life. That's really awesome.
It's not lost on me how fortunate. There's so many times in your life you're just thinking, "Boy, if I just had some help here, I could really do something."
I could see myself doing that.
And a lot of times you race around town asking for help or sending out, you know, like posting ads on Craigslist or whatever it takes. Like, can someone help me? Whatever it is, move. Does anyone have a pickup truck? Because I would, when I had my pickup truck, I would always get bothered
too.
By people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, me too. Even a year after I'd gotten rid of it, someone would call.
Yeah, someone that is, like, I got more requests from people who were friends of people I barely knew than my closest friends.
Yeah.
They go, "Hey, I'm a friend of James. You met him at a party a couple weeks ago. He said you had a pickup truck." Who is this guy James that hears that and just starts telling everybody?
Oh yeah, I know. Dave's got a truck. He'll get your recycling for you.
I was working a production when I lived in Culver City, and so the hours are brutal. Like 5 a.m. and then we'd get home, you know, like 8 o'clock at night sometimes. And a friend of some person I did know the person who had recommended her, but only through helping her move. Barely knew her other than like I helped her pick up some stuff at IKEA, and then she told a friend, and the friend was going to pay me, and I thought, all right, I'll do it because I don't know you at all.
Sure.
I'll do it for a little bit of gas money. But I said, I'm not sure when we're wrapping, and I gotta, you know, maybe we could do like 9 a.m. on like a Saturday, and we finished Friday really late at night, and I hadn't slept like much Wednesday or Thursday, and then that Friday night I got home exhausted, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night and walking to the bathroom, and I was like on a wobbly ship. I was banging into both sides of the wall. I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I must be really tired. But it felt dizzy and strange, and then I went to the bathroom, went back to sleep, and when I woke up, I was still like that.
Right.
I had a little touch of vertigo. And so I was like, I called her and said, "Hey, I gotta like chill out for a second. I'm not sure I can drive in this condition." She was not accepting of that. She was like, "Well, all right, fine. I guess I'll just have to rearrange my entire day." And I was like, "I don't know you. I don't want to do this. And I'm in dire medical attention need of it." It was terrible. And so I never helped her. And then I felt really, it's better when you like ignore or don't come through for someone that you find out is a jerk.
Oh, yeah.
It's like in...
I feel like I fall on the other side of that, where I'll just still commit to it and then regret it for a long time.
I have several instances where it's been like impactful, where I made a decision that sort of fundamentally changed how I behave. Meaning that, like, because so many times that was happening. Someone would treat me kind of crappy, and then I'd go, "That's all right," and still follow through. I'm like, why did I do
that? Because I don't see you doing that. The little I know of you, you don't seem like, you seem like you'd be like, "One strike, fuck you."
That's I think that's a learn. There was just a period. I don't know where it came from.
You're a nice guy.
It's a
nice guy thing.
I guess so. And I don't like being, when people say like, "You're a nice guy," it can be one of two ways. Like, yeah, I can push anything over on you, or like, "Oh, you're nice, and I know that you won't take a ton of crap." And that's where I'd like to be.
I think that's where I fall. Although I guess I'd probably say people that know me would be like, you're not a nice guy. No, who know me would say I am, but people who just kind of know me, uh-huh. like, why? No. You're not a nice guy at all.
Really? Oh, I hope. I guess I just kind of know you. So I was like, you're a real nice guy. Yeah. Like, reached out, offered to do this. You've given me rides to and from airports when I've been here in Boise.
Yeah, no, I'm a nice guy. I think I have a minimal bullshit tolerance level.
Yeah.
And I try to wear it on the outside so that people will know.
That's smart. I feel like that's all I'm trying to do when I don't take credit. Like, so last night at the show, there was a comedian on stage.
You were very good at that last night, yes.
No, I don't even mean when I was on stage and the people were drunk. Like, that's a learned thing from, like, substitute teaching. Like, if people get in your business, you got to pretend to be way more confident and in charge than you really are. And deep down, you're like, please shut up. Please stop talking. I was sitting in the back watching, and one of the comedians on stage, I don't know, 30 seconds into his act, someone who I know, like, leaned forward from behind me and whispered something kind of snide about him.
Oh.
And I just turned around and was like, don't whisper crap about comedians in my ear.
Nice.
Like, yeah. I didn't say, like, hey, if you wouldn't mind, please. I just flatly said it. And she looked kind of startled, like, whoa. And I was like, well, in hindsight, I think I should have, hey, if it's cool with you, if in the future, if you wouldn't, but I just don't whisper crap about comedians in my ear. Because I've had it happen a number of times, and I always feel so uncomfortable.
Oh, and yeah, that would have kicked off for sure. So that was probably a very smart move, because where we were sitting is that's where you sit to sit back and just be kind of snide about everybody on stage, for sure.
And it is a bonding thing with comedians, but you've got to really know who you're leaning in to say it to. You can't just take a shot in the dark. This guy must love negativity. Like, that guy on stage was I like him. He's not doing great, but I don't want to just burn him.
Was it me who leaned in? Was I the one?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good. Thank God.
You would remember me.
I would think so. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, if you'd have said that to me, I'd have been like, oh, okie dokie.
I remember telling my friends I had, like, several stories, but I think I've talked about one of them before, where this guy kept slapping me in the solar plexus, and I finally was just like, I don't care, and he just left me alone. He just kept whispering things to me. This wasn't at a comedy show, but I was telling my friends, like, man, I just keep getting myself in positions where I was getting, like, advice from comedians I didn't like, and they just talk my ear off, and I'd go, okay, all right.
That's interesting.
Things like that. And then my friends were like, you just gotta kind of put your foot down. And then, like, I think it was within that conversation, we were playing pool and we were right near the jukebox, and I'd put in a bunch, not a bunch, but some money.
And hours.
I had her loaded up. And that song Cool Thing by Sonic Youth came on, which I like. And
you were in a hip bar.
We were in a pretty much empty bar. We were, like, the only ones.
Yeah, but
I can't
imagine that album being on any.
Oh, true. Yeah, I think we were in maybe, like, Portland or something. So we're in their part of the world.
That makes sense.
And this guy came over and started reaching. You know how jukeboxes have that button where you can, like, skip a song?
I didn't know that, but that would drive me crazy.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating when someone does that to your song, because you can see them reach under there, and you know it's like this kill switch. You're, hey, what are you doing?
Why don't you do that to that song? The song's terrific.
So this guy starts doing it, and I go, hey, what are you doing? He goes, dude, I work here. I hear this song, like, 30 times a day.
Oh.
And so my immediate reaction is like, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. This part of the world, the Pacific Northwest. And then I remember, like, I can't keep letting people just step on me like that. So I said to him, I was just like, and it took some courage, but I was like, yeah, but I don't work here, and I paid for that song. And he just goes, all right, and wandered off. And then I was like, oh, that's all you have to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you just do that much in life, people won't tread right over you.
Yeah, but it's totally about how you feel in the moment, right?
Yeah.
It's totally about, like that when you were talking about yelling at that person who was parking in that parking spot, and how, like, your takeaway from that is like, well, next time maybe I'll just talk to them. It's totally how you feel in the moment. You're not necessarily going to tell somebody, hey, you can't park there.
Yeah, well, yeah, that story is, who in their right, she parked in a handicap spot and just wandered off. And of course your first thought is, she knows what she's doing and she's a jerk. Didn't even occur to me, oh, this person here.
Well, because that would take a level of being very pompous to assume, this is a teachable moment for this person. I couldn't explain to them the error of their way.
But it's kind of the best thing you could say if you did just go, hey, ma'am, just so you know. Because it is, it's like that 50s era judgy, like white country club lady. It's just like, I don't know if you knew, dear, but shorts aren't allowed here. And that person just feels horrible. Like, the only clothes I own. And so if you do say, I don't know if you knew this, but you can't park there. This would have been the one time in 1,000 where the person walking away would have gone, really?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You saved me from a huge ticket.
Then there's a whole cascading events of like, so does that person respond to it, or do they just, right, or are they just like, fuck you?
Yeah, because then going, you get that stare down. You get to watch them go, good to know, and just continue away. Which then I would have felt really great about getting sending her in to get that ticket.
Of course.
But instead,
it feels like what we're talking about is conflict. Conflict avoidance and conflict non-avoidant. I don't know.
Standing up for yourself or being a knight. I don't know where that came from. I think... The people listening didn't hear my beer explode to begin with. I was trying to drink some of this delicious Dagger Falls IPA brewed right here in Boise, or at least Idaho.
It's Boise.
Boise.
Sorry, I'm just kidding. Okay. I'm just kidding you.
Wait, it is brewed here? You're pronouncing the name correctly.
I'm pronouncing the name correctly, yes. I'm
so
being a dick.
I say Boise, and everyone here gets really frustrated because it's Boise.
That's so important for everyone to know that.
I get it because I'm from Nevada, and when people say Nevada, I won't stand for it.
Adda,
yeah. Okay. Like attitude. Nevada-tude. But people always say Nevada, and it's such a like an ignored state.
Because Nevada sounds like a more Midwest pronunciation of Nevada.
Yeah, I mean, some people say Colorado and Oregon.
To say Oregon just because it's annoying.
Really?
Well, just because it sounds more annoying to say Oregon.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely more annoying. Yeah. And I think the West has its sharp and kind of punchier syllables. Oregon, Colorado, Nevada.
I don't know. It's weird out here, for sure.
Anyway, I opened the beer, and you don't drink, and I wasn't going to, but I bought for my hotel room like 6 beers. There's no way I'm going to get through all of them, so I thought I'd maybe have one for our podcasting.
Now you
have
2, because one of them is not drinkable.
It just started gurgling out. It had frozen in the refrigerator. Yeah. It was really a slushy.
Did you open this one?
No, this one's still really cold, too, so I'm letting it cool down. Anyway, Dylan Haas. Is that how you say it? Haas or Haas?
Yes, Haas. I don't care. So
Waylon Jennings would have been good friends with you because he called everyone Haas.
Oh, yes. I guess that's true.
Let's go ahead and podcast, Haas.
And you, so you're a Professor Blastoff listener.
Yes.
And then we came to know each other through that. And then you were on the same bill as I was the first time I was here at Liquid Labs.
Yeah, okay, that's true. And that was because of Professor Blastoff. Like, I made sure to get on that show. That's why that.
Yeah, that feels good when people do that. And then last year I was here doing the Idaho Laughs Fest, and you were a part of that as well.
I was integral in getting you on that bill, for sure.
I appreciate it. Yeah, that worked out really well because I had the big animated thing.
Yeah, it was super cool.
And it was a huge movie theater screen, so that was fun.
Yeah.
And then, this time I'm coming through town, you said, oh, by the way, I have a PhD in, what is it, like material sciences?
Material science, yes.
So, gotta go back a little bit. I want to get into that and how that came to be and what exactly that is.
Ugh.
But I remember when you were performing, you talked about being like a fat kid.
Oh boy.
So where are you from where you were this chubby little guy?
I was in Cleveland, Ohio as a kid.
Chubby in Cleveland.
Chubby in Cleveland. More pertinent, chubby in the 80s. Because the level of fat kid I was in the 80s wouldn't just be normal size kid today.
Oh, really?
Just looking at children, yeah. I mean, I was pretty chubby, and I got, when we moved to Boise when I was 11, and then I got real fat. So.
And then you were, a line you used that I loved was, you're a fat jock.
A fat jock. Because I refused to accept that I wasn't as agile as everyone around me.
So were you the catcher and the goalie in standard chubby kid positions?
No, because I hated baseball, and I was no good at soccer, but I was obsessed with football, and I refused not to play football, and they would stick me on the line. And
of course, I had
no ability.
Hey, I'm a tailback, baby.
I was a receiver. I had exceptional hands, I was better at catching than anyone else, but I was super slow. And so they just were like, yeah, you're going to have to go here, and I had no ability to throw my weight around because I wasn't like I was a skinny little guy, and then I kind of got fat through.
I had friends that did that, like in basketball, where they topped out at 5'10", but they had been tall in, say, like fourth or fifth grade, so they played the post.
Yeah.
So they could only, like, I'm a center or maybe a forward. Like, you are the smallest guy on the floor right now.
Yeah, in basketball. I was way into basketball, and the same thing. I was just too tubby to be. I think I finally gave up around 11th grade.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
So all through that, your parents are watching you try your little chubby little heart out.
My dad
never being like, hey, let's get you on a training regimen.
No, he would try. I don't know. I'm 43, so I'm of the generation that had parents that were very neglectful, but not in like
every generation. I think now it's reversed.
Yeah, it's
really
compared to today. Compared to the type of parenting I exhibited, especially with my first child.
We come from that era where I think we can identify with even the generation above us related to their parents, who's like, oh, just go outside and play, just be gone all day.
And that's all I mean. And so he came to my games and stuff, but. He wasn't going to try and like force me to get better at it, because I think he was just like, you'll figure this out soon enough.
God, I really like that method, that approach. Yeah.
Well, and he wasn't sporty by any means. So
yeah, no, my dad wasn't sporty either. And he would come out and maybe toss the football in high school with me a little bit.
I think I remember him doing it with me a few times when I was in elementary school. But he was watching him now. I hope he never listens to this. Watching him now, like, interact with my son, I'm like, oh, right. That's why he never played with me, because he's super uncoordinated. It's kind of humorous to watch.
Yeah, it's this dark secret he was hiding. Like, yeah. Go get him, son. Like, Dad, I'm real heavy. You'll figure it out. Because, I guess I would be able to offer up, like, oh, here's what I learned, or here's what I saw. I was real small, and my...
Phone's ringing.
We'll let it. I know who it is. It's the housekeepers. There's a do not disturb sign on.
They're still making sure.
Then they call, and then I guarantee you in 5 minutes, there'll be a knock at the door.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you want anything? No, that's why the sign's there. You provide the sign for me. This concludes our business. So I guess I should have gotten that phone. Maybe it was some great opportunity.
Yeah, calling on your hotel landline.
Hey, it's Built to Spill. You want to come hang out with us?
There it is. There's a knock on the door.
Really?
No, thank you.
Okay. I hope that picked up.
Just making sure the sign is accurate. You didn't just leave it here on accident.
We want it written and then audibly in two ways told no. Then you'll get no. And I do need towels now because it's beer. I had to clean it up with one of their towels.
And now you
shoot. I'll track them down later. I was real small going into high school and terrified about it. All my teeth hadn't come in yet.
What?
Yeah, it was. I mean, they were coming in, but real slow. And
did you go ninth through?
Yeah, high school was 9 through 12.
Okay.
So in eighth grade, I think 7th grade was the worst, but it was understandable. Like, most kids had their full teeth in 7th grade. I was still losing some.
I guess that makes sense. I don't even think about it anymore, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why those things stick with me. Because I remember at the time, when you're 15 and you look back and go, I don't know, I guess I was 9 or 10. And you know in your head, like, I was 12.
Yeah.
And there was no excuse to be whatever I'm lying about now.
I guess I was 9.
And we probably all do that all the time still. Oh, I must have been 22 or 3. Like, you were 30.
I still have, because going into...
Nah, I'm gonna wait.
Going into junior high, I remember just being petrified that we were going to have to shower at gym. And I was just like, not down for that.
You know that scene in Freaks and Geeks when he's all terrified of that? My friend, so we show up with our bags and we had to get t-shirts made with our names, our last names on them. And the gym teacher comes out and tells us that. The showers are in there. You'll be required to shower. If you'd like to bring a bathing suit, you can. And several people turned around and looked at me like... And I was like, oh, I could have pubes, you don't know.
It's exactly that. It's the pubes. I was like, in seventh grade too. And I don't think most people had gone through puberty yet, because we didn't wind up having to shower until 10th grade. And I remember having the same paranoia, because I still had not gone through puberty. Even by ninth grade, I was just barely getting anything on my legs. Thankfully, through the summer, I had enough that I looked like a normal, mature boy.
Not me. And so I was so thin and so small that I felt like I gotta gain gained some weight. I just watched the movie Above the Rim.
Nice.
Many, I'd watch it on loop. And he like has this training thing where he gets up and works out in the morning before school.
Yeah.
So a neighbor was moving or something, gave away like this weight bench set. And I grabbed that and was like, I've got some weights. And then I cut off the sleeves on a sweatshirt so that I would have kind of the same getup that he did. And then I would make some baked potatoes the night before, like two little ones. And then my mom would get up and heat them in the microwave in the morning and sit with me while I ate baked potatoes and drank like muscle gainer or weight gainer.
Really?
Yeah. I was desperately trying to gain weight and then I'd lift my weight.
Did it work at all?
Didn't gain an ounce.
Not 1 ounce. Okay.
Didn't help at all. But I tried for like a few weeks and then... Wow. Just didn't take. So, and my mom.
3 weeks, I was still not ripped, so fuck it.
So, what you needed was an above the rim of your own. You needed, like, this kid that loses all the weight.
Yeah, I finally did that between junior and senior year, or like Christmas to Christmas, junior to senior year. I finally.
Yeah.
Because I was like 196 pounds. I was almost 200 pounds. I was 5'3" or something. It was reaching the point where it was the tipping point that I would go one, I would have one path of my life or another. And so, I lost a bunch of weight. I did my own training thing. And then, I don't know, I'd say I became quite narcissistic and obsessed with my looks for the next 20 years at least. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. I bet that could happen where.
Oh, for sure. It's the last like 5-6 years I've spent trying very, very hard to focus on that, getting away from that. And weirdly, I've put on a little weight since then.
You look healthy, though.
I'm very healthy. Yeah. That's the point that I'm trying to focus on is feeling healthy, being healthy versus.
Were you picked on? Because there's always that kid that, like, not that he's picked on, but maybe ignored, and then they show up and all of their online photos are just them at the gym or them flexing or like at the lake.
I can't imagine what it would have been like had all that stuff been available then. Like, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
I felt more outsider and ostracized than I probably was because I still was like class president.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's no reason
like me. Yeah. And I think girls didn't like me. That was the critical thing. Like, I was funny and people.
Well, that's why those guys end up putting on all the muscle, right?
No, yeah. And it was immediate. Like, as soon as, because my whole incentive was to get laid. And literally it happened. Like, as soon as I lost weight and got the attention of any girls, it was just like, boom, 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 boom. And which is not a positive thing for my psyche moving forward, but it was terrific for 17-year-old me.
Yeah, but it's terrible. Like, God, people like you for who you are, and then you lose the weight. Nope, turns out it's all physical.
It's all physical. Well, and you start turning the heads of attractive girls that you want to get their attention. That's an intoxication. So
then what led from that to, you went to high school here in Boise, and mm-hmm. then you went and studied where?
Physics at Boise State.
Okay.
So I stay here. I hung around far too long. I hung around this city, and now I'm stuck here.
You don't like it here?
I love it here.
It's gorgeous.
No, I love it. That's why I stay. I mean, I went to BSU for a physics degree, and it was, again, like all this stuff was before Boise is what it is today. It was not great 20 years ago. It was a very lame downtown, very lame scene. It was very.
But it was still a college town.
It was more of like a. More of like a community college feel
to the
university, and honestly, like the department, the physics department, like we brought in a certain professor who's now the head of the department, and like time wise, it was like right at the cusp of it becoming more of a real a serious university feeling, more of a college town feel, and so I was part of that. Like on the end of it being a community college feel to me, because when I went there was a ton of old people going to school.
Yeah,
and it wasn't like today where there's sororities and it feels like a
prominent football team that everyone knows nowadays.
Well, to me that's what really kicked it over is that I mean people have negative things about everything, I guess, but I've never viewed that popularity of the football team as anything but a bonus for everything in town, because it's kicked off so much importance about this city.
Every time I'm here now, there is a new crane building some new giant building. Yeah.
No, it's a happening place. It's a beautiful place to live now. 25 years ago, everybody was just scrambling to get the hell out. Like the teenagers, my daughter, my 16-year-old, and I don't know, I worked with people who were in their early 20s over the last few years, and they've, there's people who've never been to Portland or never been to Seattle, which for my generation, like the second you could drive that far, you were going, because there wasn't shit going on here. So if you wanted to see a good show, if you wanted to do anything entertaining, you had to leave town. It's not
so does that give
anymore.
You a sense of pride to sort of be like, I've been here through it all.
Oh.
Like, I'm one of the originators.
I even like this festival. I keep thinking, if this would have been around when I was in my 20s, I would have really, really enjoyed it. Like,
yeah.
I'm too old now. I just am like, you guys are stupid. Get out of my face. Even just walking, I got here a few minutes before I come up.
Yeah.
So I walked over to grab some coffee and just in that little 2-block meander, saw so many people that I'm like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to look. No eye contact.
I've heard a bunch of people say that, but maybe it's just from living in Los Angeles or like, I'm, you know, Portland and Seattle, or not Seattle, San Francisco from time to time. And that looks normal to me.
It does. Yeah. It's totally abnormal. And it's just me being uninterested in making eye contact with people is all it is. I think it's great. It makes me happy that this is going on here for sure.
All right. So you were one of the community college nerds studying physics.
Studying physics. Yeah, there was like 6 majors. That was it. And mm-hmm. 6 people in the department as students.
What drew you to physics?
Oh, boy. Nothing. That's the thing. Like, it was the fact that I was good at it. Like,
that's it. Did you have like an influential teacher in high school or anything like that?
No, not at all. Like, I didn't show an aptitude for anything like that. Other than once I like figured out math, it just clicked and it was just fine. And that was it. Like, I was a kind of a dirtbag. You know, I was working as a dishwasher, eating LSD a couple times a week, you know, just partying hard.
Yeah, college experience.
Yeah, no, this was, and then I even dropped out and I was just doing that. And so I was living here in a time when there was not shit going on in this city.
Yeah.
Working at a restaurant, being a fucking stoner and smart enough to recognize that the 40-year-old guy two cooks down the line was a very likely future for me if I didn't figure something out.
Yeah, that's always weird to see. When I was subbing or when I was shoeing horses mm-hmm. or anything, I inevitably saw someone where I'm like, oh, that could be me.
Yeah.
Some were better than others and kind of tempting for whatever reason. Like, eh.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I got
that line, the guy washing dishes, deters you pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, I got into the kitchen at least and was at least like, learning, and I got pretty good at cooking, but again, same thing. I was like, I don't know if this is what I want to be, because I also had enough awareness that I would just die. Like, I'm just an obsessive personality, and I would just continue to drink and continue to use drugs, and it would probably destroy me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just took a stab at it and decided to just go back and study physics, because I'd taken one class and had done okay at it, and I think my grandfather had died, and so then I kind of just quit going and dropped out, and mm-hmm. You know, it took a year or so off. And so, yeah. And then my competitive nature kicked in and I insisted on being the best in the class at all times. And so...
Did your competitive nature, like, it made you want to be the best at physics?
Yeah, well, in the class, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, so it's a small pond, so it's not that hard. But, like, I was taking classes with primarily engineers, because like I said, there was barely any science majors there. I was no good at chemistry, so I just stayed away from chemistry at all costs. But like any physics, any calculus, you know, those kind of based mathematical based science, I just gravitated to the top in all the classes, and so it just felt more and more natural, like, oh, I should do this. And
are
I remember,
you like kind of a type A guy to begin with?
I don't really know. I guess I am. No, I don't know why I say I don't know why. I mean, the 3 hours I spent before coming here, I was cooking, folding laundry, and making sure the children were cleaning the house, you know, so I'm very, very tidy person, okay. So yes, I am type A.
Okay.
But, like I said, I was a druggy at the time. So
yeah, chubby kid to druggy.
Yeah.
It was like this weird transition.
Yeah,
into
and I just kind of, I think by being someone who, like, because until I got really into physics, I would smoke pot constantly, like,
mm-hmm.
whatever, every day.
And those can go hand in hand a little bit, right?
Sure.
Like, that's the thing. When I was in school, I didn't realize, like, physicists a lot of times they tend toward a hippier side more so than, like, I'm a scientist. And
yeah,
I just
they do,
like,
for sure. Engineers are more like the prototypical, I'm a little,
Yeah.
But I had to stop eventually just because I one afternoon did a bunch of my calculus homework after smoking a lot of pot. And then the next day when I looked at it, I was like, wow, none of this is even making any sense at all. Which is, it's a disturbing realization that you're
did
like...
at the time, though.
Yeah. It's one of those like, what was I thinking? This is not in any way accurate.
Wow.
So that was the reason I quit smoking pot. And for a while there... Everything I had a handle on in terms of like drugs and alcohol, like as I was able to just kind of drink a little bit when I needed to, or whatever, like at the end of the night just to cool off or go out and party a little bit. But by the time I got to graduate school, I started drinking very heavily. So, I graduated from BSU and got into a material science program at the University of Arizona.
To get your master's?
Yeah, well, my intention always, from the moment I started, was to go be a professor. I just wanted to teach.
That's interesting because, I mean, just compared to me, like, I had a teacher in high school who I loved, Jim Isolo, if you're out there, made an impact on me. He was so cool. Virtually everyone in the class passed the AP exam because he was just real laid back and everyone got it. He taught physics in a very laid back way and was like, if you don't want to be here, you can take a class off and I won't make it count for your attendance. I want you to want to be here if you're here. And people made it to his class a lot. Yeah. And there were days when I was like, I'm not going to go. And I would just show up the next day and be like, yeah, yesterday I just wasn't into it. He's like, that's fine.
Right.
And just trusted us. This was high school. Okay. And he just trusted us. And, however, I don't think maybe it's a Nevada thing or where I was from. There was never a track or a path where like adults were saying, well, if you get into this, this is what you become. I just thought physics was something you know that you add on as like a patch in the pursuit of something else.
That is what you wind up using it for a lot of the time, unless you want to go teach physics. And that's what I was like, I want to go teach physics. I want to get into this because it was very
rich. Yeah, I feel like and maybe it's because you took a year off or just the awareness of that. And I don't think that would have appealed to me to be a teacher, but the fact that you knew like, oh, there is a future in just physics.
Well, and that's what happened though is when I was graduating, because like I said, we brought in the professor who is now the head of the department, and I was part of the, you know, there was only six students at the time, so we got our input was valued.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, Jesus, there's over 300 applicants for this one podunk job as a professor in this nowhere university.
Yeah.
And this guy's fucking amazing.
Right.
There's no future in this job. I'm never going to be as smart as this guy. And this guy, you know, he got his degree or his PhD from Stanford, I believe. And like, it discouraged me from that path. And so he became my advisor and mentor. And he was like, well, why don't you look at this? Material science is kind of an up and coming field. And the job opportunities are more available there. So I did that. And that's why when you're like, what is material science? Like, I never clicked on it. It was a means to an end. Like it's kind of a combination. It's basically what any metallurgy became material science. I mean, it was born from metallurgy, but then it's kind of absorbed all solid state science. And it's kind of a combination of physics and chemistry is the way I've described it. I don't know if that's still accurate. There's a strong material science department at Boise State now. I mean, it really has in the last.
Did you guys get to? Oh, sorry. Go.
Well, I was just going to say, as a field, it's grown significantly in the last 15 years. And like you said, you've never really heard of it, but like moving forward, everyone will. It'll just be just like any other when I was civil engineering or whatever.
Yeah. When I was at Colorado State, those were classes we took. They were required, you know, materials, solids.
Right.
There was a higher level one beyond materials, but I think that was the required one. Just basic materials, and we would go into the lab and like do torsion tests on
bars
exactly of steel and stuff.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, those are really fun. You just watch like this giant hydraulic machine tear stuff
and those
apart.
Are cool. And I sat in on some of those labs, but going into it as a graduate student, I didn't have any of that like preliminary stuff. I didn't come into it as an undergrad. So walking into the department, I was like, pleased as punch to get in. And then I realized like even like the seniors in the school have a much better understanding of all the basics than me. Unless we're talking about specific physics things that I can like, oh yeah, I'm really good at this part of it. But like all the other stuff around it, I was like,
I would imagine wanting to pursue continue your education, you had an understanding of what those things meant that would carry over. Because I think a lot of people cram, they learn stuff, and you get to the next class and you don't look at a bar with some forces on it and go, I know exactly what's happening here. And you go, shit, I got to go back to my notes.
Exactly.
I don't know what this
means. And that's what was so appealing about physics. It's everything can be deduced from primary, early principles. Like if you have the right time and the amount of like headspace, you can get to everything from one bare set of principles.
And you're on the bigger end, levers, pulleys, wedges, simple machines, the bigger, more physical physics moving toward. And then this is a terrible, in my mind, the scale goes from something like that, like to then out to the giant astrophysics side, and then back down into like the quantum side.
Exactly.
And you're in that nice meaty middle, like there's a better physical representation of a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, okay. but physics also dictates all. I mean, physics is everything.
Yeah.
And that's, and I, you know, after I got finished with my degree, I was like, I should have just stayed with physics. It would have been much, I mean, because in the end, it was just as frustrating. I wound up studying something that, or doing my thesis work on something that ultimately was like, this is boring as fuck. I feel bad for, like, because my professor was very into it, and I just kind of grabbed onto it as a means to an end. Like, yeah. I was like, you know, because all the stuff in my life, I got married, I had children, and so it was like, I need to get a job. And so I left the university, I finished my master's, and then within a year...
And that's Arizona...
U of A. Down in Tucson, yeah.
Okay.
And wound up getting a job back here in Boise at the big semiconductor firm, Micron.
And what were you doing there? What is your master's in... And that is still just in physics, right?
No, material science.
So your master's was in material science.
Okay. Yeah, and I think my professor was like being pragmatic, and he's like, well, get your master's and we'll continue working on your PhD. But I think he could see the writing on the wall. He's like, this guy's going to take off before he's done.
Yeah.
Which is what I did, but I still finished. So, I mean, I did all my work. I did all the lab work necessary, and then spent 6 more years barely plunking away at it to get it finalized, you know, after I'd left the
yeah.
university, which if anybody out there is considering doing that, do not do that. Stick
Don't
around for the extra
year.
Stick yeah. around for the extra year. Skip going to get a job. Finish your fucking degree and then leave.
Finish your PhD.
Anything. If you're thinking of leaving and you think you can still focus enough on it to complete it after the fact, you won't. You'll quit. It's
Why was it hard? I mean, we blurred over a couple of things. you somehow met someone that you decided to become married to.
I was actually with her here. We met in high school.
Oh, okay.
We had known each other in high
school. And she liked you for being thin.
She liked me for being fat.
Oh,
actually, which
you
is
came
part
back
of why.
Around.
No, because she knew me from before I lost weight, and we were friends. And we were friends all night. We didn't date in high school or anything. Mm-hmm. We were just friends, and we hung out, and then we were part of the little punk rock scene that was fostering here in the early 90s in Boise, and I don't know, we just got together and okay. So she was with me that whole time, and it's part of why, like, being a dirtbag started to be less appealing, because she was not interested in that, and so
yeah.
it was one of those, like, using another person's to improve yourself, which has its goods and its bads, and
yeah,
in the end I think a lot of that turned out to be probably more negative than it should have been. My fault, I'm going to accept. But anyway, that was part of why I was excited about going to University of Arizona, because her family was from Tucson, and so she got a job down there at the same time. So
okay.
that it all worked out really well, so that we could live in an area where we weren't completely alone. We had family, and it was, you know, good for her, good for
yeah.
me. And
then you did, so at you were just there 1 year to get your master's?
It took me, I think, yeah, I guess about a year and a half.
And then you guys are having children during that period?
Yeah, she was big pregnant right then. I graduated in the December period, and then my first daughter, my daughter was born in January. So it was like big mm-hmm. pregnant right there.
Yeah.
And then of 2000.
And then the semiconductor job.
It was 2001. So okay. then I spent another year working on my PhD stuff, and she was a school teacher. And after, like, I don't know, half a year of going back to school after having a newborn, she was just like, I don't want to work. I want to stay home with the kid. And so the opportunity was there to get a job at Micron. So I took it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
do you like it? Like, I think that there's so many ways to look at
it. Did I like working?
Did you
at
like
Micron?
It at the time? Like working, or did you look at it like, I've got a family, I just got to have
was
a
that.
Job.
It was that. And it was, like I said, it wasn't like, I just didn't feel integrated into the material science program. Like mm-hmm.
But you did pass it. You did get
yeah,
your
yeah. I mean, all my classes and the graduate level classes, I would apply myself, and there were certain classes that were more physics based, I guess, for lack of a better description, you know, like
yeah.
physical chemistry. And it's like
yeah.
you get kind of a physical chemistry light by
yeah.
taking through the material science department. So it's, you know, like chemistry majors would look at that my understanding of P-Chem would be like, you don't get P-Chem. And I would be like, yeah, I don't get P-Chem. I get it enough to pass this class.
Uh-huh.
But I just felt like I just wanted to get out. I mean, after a while of being in graduate school, you're like, I just, you know, especially if you got a kid, you know.
And being, you know, LSD isn't just something to sip on like a drink. You're like, well, I'm done with that. Like, it might alter your
perceptions
a
little bit.
Yeah. So now you're stuck in this job where you're like, I got to have a job.
Yeah.
And I would imagine some of your LSD conversations are going like, dude, this you only get to go through this once,
and it's
man.
Corporate. Oh, my God. No, you know what I did is I set that voice aside for years. Uh-huh. For years. And, because I wound up at a job in a cubicle, which I just resigned myself to doing because it was just what I needed to do. And
everyone, we all do that. We slog through a period and you go, this is just a period.
That's the problem is when you're pushing 30 and you're getting a corporate job that's paying you very well and you get good benefits and you can support a family, it becomes much more harder to then turn around and be like, now I'm going to go try something else that'll make me $11,000 next year.
I want to get into longboarding.
Yeah. And my ex, she was not down for that. Like she got real into the Micron wife lifestyle.
Ooh,
yeah. I mean, and I fostered it. And
so she was the country club lady.
Not quite as black and white as that. But yeah, I mean, she enjoyed being able to afford things.
And, it's nice to be able to eat food
and drive a fairly nice car and be able to take the kids and buy them neat things and do, and you know, and then we started pumping out more kids and more kids, and she wanted a nicer house, so we got a nicer house.
You guys had three kids together.
We had three kids together, yeah.
And got a nicer house.
Yeah.
And just kept doing it how they, like that always happens in movies or when you hear people talking about like, and I was just trapped in it, man.
It's exactly
like a bigger house.
Oh my gosh, it is exactly it. And in the middle of all that, I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking after my daughter was born in 2000. A little while after, like, because I was being in graduate school, I would spend most of the day, I would hang out with my daughter because I could set my schedule however I needed, with the exception of classes. I would just stay home with my kid while my wife worked, and then we'd swap out and I'd go work down at the university till whatever in the evening.
Yeah.
But I got real good at just kind of getting a little tipsy throughout the day and then finish it off when I got home. And one night, you know, she came home and like, I don't remember exactly what it was, but like between her going into the shower and coming out, and I was just hanging out with the baby, you know, a 2-month-old, I got smashed, right? Like
in
short
amount of time?
Well, as far as she could tell, I had been drinking gin all day. And so I had like one more cup or whatever, enough to tip me over to the point where you can no longer pass as not being trashed.
Yeah.
And she was just like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
And so I quit. You're like right then I was like, yeah, no, you're right, baby, I gotta quit. And some people can do that. It's a tough thing to do, and I quit, and that lasted for about 4 years. But the bigger house is the funny thing you say that, because we got a little house here and I got the job and I started working corporate life and living in a cubicle and, you know, being in hell but just accepting it. And then eventually she wanted this nicer house, and I got us in on the nicer house, and it was a big old Victorian. It was a beautiful house, but I had, you know, it was like constantly, anytime my income would increase a little bit, I was just pushing myself to the maximum credit limit at that level. So it was just like further and further into debt and getting this bigger house.
That's so weird, because everyone probably sees you going out to dinner and showing up in a nice car and let me get this one. I'm like, oh, they do fine.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a total pseudo lifestyle that, you know, it was the bubble that popped in 2008, right?
Yeah.
I was a big at the center of that for sure. And yeah, I just somewhere in there after we got the house, we go like, I started drinking again. And
how did she react to that?
She didn't know.
Because
because that was the thing. She was so disturbed by how I had been drinking before that it had become this like understood, like if you drink again, this probably everything's gonna end.
Yeah.
And so when I decided to start drinking again,
was it a pull? Was it something you couldn't get away from? Or was it weird?
It was kind of a combination of that. It was, I had some wine in the house, and my family was gone for a week because I was gonna change out the kitchen floor. Uh-huh. So she stayed in Tucson. We had gone down to visit, and then she stayed with her kids, two kids at the time. And then I came home with the intention of spending the week working on the floor, like after I got home from work or whatever. And so I just had this like fuck it attitude, and I just kind of started drinking some wine. And it, oh boy, that sensation of getting drunk for the first time after like 4.5 years of not having any alcohol in my system, I still remember it. Like you can see it in my face right now. It's like euphoric recall of like,
this your like eyes just oh went my, out into
I,
the distance.
I know it was, and that's how I felt. Like I was in the basement of my house, this unfinished basement, like chugging two buck chuck from the bottle.
Yeah,
and just was like, I literally had this thought of welcome back, friend, of like, and it just kind of progressed from there. Like I would drink on the weekends, but always on the sly. I would just have a beer, like kind of stash a beer, mm-hmm. And it just progressed and progressed. And I don't know, I guess that was 2004. And then by 2007, I was like drinking daily, like to the point of intoxication. And because I was keeping it secret, I got really good at pretending to not be drunk. And so, I don't know if you want me to continue down that path of what all
it's
all
up
that
to you, man.
To.
I think everyone has a different one, and it's fascinating
sure.
every time to me, because some people just, I had to stop cold turkey, and then
that's what, and the cold turkey thing, and for me, it just didn't work. And I am very suspicious of anybody who feels that they have really stopped. Well, no, that's not true, because you can stop drinking,
mm-hmm.
but what I eventually learned is that's not really the issue. Like, I had a lot of other problems in my life that I wasn't addressing,
mm-hmm.
which is why basically I had started drinking. And the more that would get on me, I would just numb it out. And so, you know,
yeah.
I was still working that job, and I was progressing in it to some degree, although I never really loved it. So
you were becoming that like cliche suburb
yeah.
guy.
I absolutely was. And
wow.
it's very weird to look back on it, because I feel like I'm not the same person. It's hard to like, I don't know. Square who I am today with who I was 10 years ago.
Well, I want to get into that, how you got into comedy.
But first, an advertisement for
well, let's take a little quick break, and then
go ahead. I feel bad about that, because I'm around people, obviously.
Yeah,
I'm
at the comedy club
all the time. If I was of the attitude that people felt uncomfortable drinking around me, I would be just shunned. Nobody would want to be around me.
Okay.
And I just, because that doesn't do anybody any good. Like, I would assume that you're probably going to have that beer, and you're probably not going to wind up ass face down on the ground at the end of the night, because you started off with a sockeye at 3 in the afternoon, and by midnight you just couldn't stop slamming shots of Fireball or something.
I had that one sockeye. All right, so I have so many questions. I don't even know what material science is yet, and then we got to get into the PhD
sure.
part, and this is a good breaking point, so
okay.
let's take a quick
one. Can we
set
this
here.
Down so I can grab some water?
Absolutely. Dylan Haas, part one. Come back next week for part two. I hope he found that compelling. I really enjoyed chatting with him, and I hope the ambient sound of the Tree Fort Festival in the background wasn't a distraction. I kind of enjoyed that, and that's kind of how it was. It was kind of alive, but not, you know, not rude. Not people weren't fighting each other or yelling. It's just kind of a lot of music and whatnot. Anyway, we'll continue more with him. Kind of talking about material sciences, but more just talking about his life and talking about what, how he got his PhD. And I think he's just a fascinating guy. So hopefully you'll check that out. And thanks for rating the show. And if you'd like to donate or be a guest or suggest anything, thespacecave.com is the best way to do that. Space_cave on Twitter. If you'd like to be one of the people who chats with me, just tweet your number and I'll call you and we'll chat. You can donate at the website. You can follow me at Huntsberger Junk on Twitter. And my website's davidhuntsberger.com. I'll be at Acme Comedy Club all this week. And if you're listening to this early in the morning on Monday the 26th, there's a city hall meeting, city council or something like that, to discuss the parking situation with the Acme Comedy Club, which has been a home for me, one of the best places in my career in comedy. And I would just feel terrible if they weren't able to keep the doors open. And there is a progress, more humanitis encroaching on them and potentially taking away some of their parking. So if you are in the area and you'd like to keep that club open, which I hope you do, check out my website. I'll have some links there. But mostly, check out acmecomedyco.com and see if you can be a part of that city council meeting and help them stave off development, encroaching on them and making it really difficult for them to keep the doors open. I hope you're you know, active in that, and if you live in Minneapolis. Anyway, let's get out of here, you guys. Come to Acme. Come say hello this week if you are there. It's the end of this nothingness tour. Thanks to everyone who's come out and said hello along the Midwestern journey that I've been on. And I might be doing some more touring in the fall, but we'll see. We'll see how that goes. Anyway, let's get out of here. This is some music from a band called Blouse, which you may have heard of. The song I'm about to play has a pretty decent amount of views online. So I typically like to play, songs from bands that are just barely forming. This one seems like it's going to go somewhere, but this song is so catchy. If you've heard it, you like it, and if you haven't, check them out. I think they're great, and like to shine a little more light on them. So, anyway, this is off the album Imperium, I believe, and this song is called Into Black. This is Blouse. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.
Like a picture. You know you'll never be the same.